It seems that one of the greatest addictions we have is to imagining that we can figure life out. It's really a great addiction. Mind's always trying to figure life out, whether it's life in general or the specifics of any given situation. In fact, there's an addiction to thinking that there is something to figure out. And it's primarily this addiction to trying to figure things out, which itself is what creates so much turmoil. This idea, deep set idea, that I can figure this out. I can figure life out. I can figure enlightenment out. I can figure death out. I can figure something out. You know, it's really quite a joke. And so you get into a moment of confusion or a moment of doubt, some challenge, some difficulty. And the mind goes into overdrive. How do I figure this out? Even something sometimes is as simple of an instruction is like, be still. The first thing the mind wants to know about be still is how. It's trying to figure it out. So as long as we're asking how, there's no stillness, because there's no stillness in how do I be still. When you realize that there is no how to be still, then that is itself stillness. When you realize there is no how, there is no answer to the question. I suppose that's another one of our addictions too. We think that there are answers to all our questions. In fact, we think that our questions need to be answered. And if they get answered, then I promise I'll be happy. I just need to figure this one thing out, you see, this last thing. I promise, says the mind, this is going to be the last one. I know it's never worked out, really, because of all the answers to questions that I've gotten and all the things I figured out in my life, here I am once again trying to figure something out. But I'm sure this will be the last time. I promise, says the mind. Just let me figure this last thing out, and I'm sure I'll never have anything to figure out again. But isn't it a joke? Isn't it just one, and then the mind goes, well, you solved that problem, let's go to the next. Let's conjure up a new one, and let's conjure up a new one. And that was so fun, let's conjure up a new one. Do you know? So for all the struggling that we human beings do to not be so disturbed all the time, because mostly we're disturbed by our minds or somebody else's mind. Of course, somebody else's mind can't disturb us unless we're using it to disturb ourselves. Does that make sense? Yeah. Even if to the extent if somebody just walks up to you some days and just says, you know, a friend or something, and they just decide, I hate you. What they say can't. It's literally impossible for those words to hurt you. Those words have an impossibility of having any effect on you whatsoever. It's what your mind does with those words, right? It's what your mind does with those words. So it's your mind that hurts you. Does that make sense? Over the years, I've had so many occasions where people have said, you know, I was at a talk, Ajahn, and I saw the way you looked at me, and I could tell you were upset with me. And and I understand that, because, you know, we've all had human experience, right? We've all had human experience. But, you know, almost always I'm kind of like, and what talk was that? Where were you? That's our mind, isn't it? Mind wants to know what's the meaning of everything? What does that look mean? What does it mean that you, what you said? What does it mean? So it's our mind are always, it's always creating meaning, isn't it? Significance. And so we're using our thinking to try to figure our way, to try to think our way out of thinking, out of being caught in the turmoil of thinking. And as I said yesterday, most of you have probably had the experience in certain environments, your thinking can either be either settle down or it can be settled down. When it's not being challenged, when there's really nothing to do. Of course, for a long time, most minds, when there's nothing to do, that's when they really turn on themselves the most. Do you know? It's like the worst thing you can do to a mind is give it space to do nothing. But nothing to do. It's a catastrophe. Do you know? Because the mind just goes nuts when there's nothing to do. And of course, this isn't just a personal dilemma, is it? It's a collective dilemma. It's collections of human beings, all certain that they can figure it all out, do you know? The greatest philosophers, the greatest theologians, the greatest, you know, politicians, theorists, the greatest of them, the biggest minds, what a disaster. What a disaster. How many more wars do we got going right now, you know? Not only for our country, but around the world. What a disaster. You know, how many people bickering at each other? You know what I mean? You see, it's just almost laughable unless you take it too seriously. You know, you turn on the TV, you look for some news. All you find out is two idiots arguing. And it's news, and we're supposed to get something out of that. You know? They taught us this. I remember being taught that in college. You know, you have two opposing views, and if you get two opposing views together and get them going at each other, somehow you'll come up with something better. I suppose every once in a while it works out that way. You know, sometimes when you're in relationship with ideas and stuff, sometimes something better than you could have come up with, either one of you on your own, every now and then. But usually one is so entrenched in their own viewpoint that nothing happens, you know. And yet we believe in this, do we not? We believe. Just another idea. I remember reading many, many years ago a wonderful book, and it was about Thomas Merton, and the Trappist monk that was probably the greatest or the most widely read Catholic, certainly Catholic monk in the last 100 years. And he was being asked at the time, this was back in the Cold War, about different political systems. You know, and that's when we were fighting communism. Do you know, we're fighting communism. We always have to fight something. You ever notice? When one thing's gone, we'll fight something else. And when that's gone, we'll fight. There's no end to the fighting. We just switch things to fight. It's like a bully, you know? Oh, I've beat up you. Now I'll just go beat up, you know, whatever. Anyway, it's a universal thing. Everybody's doing it to each other. But someone asked him about different political systems. And at that time, of course, communism was a big thing. And, you know, everybody, a lot of people were all scared by it and everything. And all these discussions about different political systems. And he said, you know, what I've found, he traveled quite widely around the world, as he said, a political system is about as good or bad as the people who make it up. Which means the people who implement it and run it and are in it and support it. In other words, what he was saying is, you know, it's the people. It's not the system, really. It's the people that that are operating it, right? It's a consensus state of consciousness that in whatever system you're in will mirror back to us the consensus state of consciousness. Will it won't? The overall state of consciousness. The overall view. And so you can even take something like back then, you could take a communist idea, which is, you know, in its ideal form, very egalitarian, very sort of a lot of selflessness. And, you know, in one sense, it's not a particularly bad idea. It's just that you're asking human beings to implement the idea, and then it becomes terrible, right? Because it becomes not egalitarian at all, right? It becomes dictatorial, right? Why? Because it's human beings that implement it. And so the idea that we impose upon each other will never actually be able to, it only can modify the insanity at best. In that sense, certain political systems are better than others. Some modify insanity better than others modify insanity. Some work a little bit better than others, you know. Just, I don't know who the famous person was there asked about democracy. Somebody quite famous who had said, you know, well, it's a terrible system, but it's the best there is. It's really messy, but it's the best we currently have, you know. What's that? Winston Churchill, yes. Sounds like something Winston Churchill would say, wouldn't it? It's probably one of the reasons that people both loved and hated him, you know. Because a statement like that, you can both, you know, love and hate depending on your current fixation. So we do it collectively. We keep trying to impose ideas. And we do it individually. And we're always trying to figure everything out. When the Buddha had his enlightenment, at some point he referred to the ego as the whole self as a ridgepole. You know, like if you think of a big circus tent, and there's a ridgepole, the central pole that would hold up these massive tents, and he said that the ridgepole had been pulled out and the whole tent had collapsed. And he talked sometimes about the ego as that ridgepole or as the house builder. It's the house builder that goes in there and puts up that ridgepole and erects the whole fabrication of self. And he has this wonderful way of describing that ridgepole being pulled out, everything sort of falling down. And then he says, now I know you, and you can't build this house again. Now I know you, which is a really important statement, because it is one thing to have a moment where the egoic self seems to disappear, or you wake up from it and you realize it's not containing your identity. It's another thing to really be able to spot it when it tries to put itself back together. Because just because you wake up from it, just because it sort of falls away at some point in time, does not mean that it will not try to erect itself, right? And this mind is tremendously subtle and sophisticated in the way that that central pillar called me will try to erect itself again. Some of the ways are really obvious and, you know, dense, and some of them are extraordinarily subtle and very, very sophisticated. It takes quite a lot of experience to notice it. It's part of the reason that we sit in silence, is you can see at some point when you get done trying to solve your mind, and you kind of give up on solving your mind, then your mind starts to solve itself in a way, it starts to settle down. But at a certain point, you start to be able to see how your own mind structure recreates that center called me, self, ego. How does it do that? In the obvious ways, and how is the very, very subtle ways, how does it reconstruct itself out of nothing? And so it's not that there are any evil intentions in ego or illusion, or it's, you know, there's not really no bad guy in any of this. It's really this, we're educated this way. We're taught this way. We are taught that you're going to figure it all out, do you know? In some ways we're taught that overtly, and sometimes some ways we just sort of observe it in our culture, and it's sort of subverted way, an under the radar way that we're taught that we're taught how to relate to the mind. What we're not taught is how to listen. That we're not taught very well. Because to listen, we have to stop asserting, right? The mind has to come into a different state. It has to relinquish trying to create something, and it has to come into a totally different state. A bit more passive state, we may say, even though I know the word passive in our culture has negative connotations. But I'm using the word passive in the sense that when you walk through the forest, your mind can be in a really passive, receptive state, right? Not only your mind, but your senses of hearing and feeling and tasting, and you become very open. To become very open, the mind has to become sort of porous, right? Sort of relaxed and loose, passive in that sense. So we're okay with being our mind being loose and open and passive. I mean, most people aren't, but in nice circumstances, you know, walking through the forest, walking along the beach on a beautiful day, you know, whatever it is, when there's really nothing that you have to do. But as soon as there's something to do, the mind sort of thinks, okay, now that's nice when I'm enjoying a sunset, but that's relatively worthless when I have to do something. And so the mind, our whole system stops listening. We go from a state of listening to a state where the mind is constantly asserting itself. Constantly, 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 constantly. Because mostly we're not told that actually when the mind comes into a state of listening, of openness, when it becomes porous and available, then and only then there's another kind of intelligence that can start to inform the mind. And there's one kind of intelligence that's a product of mind, right? That's the kind of intelligence that you might have if you're a, you know, mathematician, or you're, I don't, you know, most jobs you have to have that kind of mind, right? You have to have a mind that knows how to assert itself, how to think things through, how to be rational, logical. You know, that's a really, it's a good thing to be able to do. It's funny, for all the training we do of people's minds, the last thing we ever teach a mind how to do is simply to be rational. You know, just rational in your thinking process. I mean, that's not something that I think most people can get all the way through 4 or 6 years of college without ever anybody ever talking about how to be rational about more than most anything. Do you know? What we're usually taught is make your point and how to argue it. Write your paper, convince me that you're right. Do you remember that in high school? You know? Who cares if you're rational? Just make it convincing. Do you know? Because you can make gibberish convincing. I don't know if you're a good writer, you can make nonsense sound fantastic. You know. But what we're not taught is that when one comes into a state of listening or receptivity, It's not just a listening and receptivity for its own sake, but there's, like it would be maybe when you're walking through the forest and enjoying a sunset or sitting on your porch or that kind of receptivity. But there's a type of receptivity that also gives you access to a completely different level of intelligence, of truth. And it's not the kind of intelligence you get through this sort of the rational thinking process that we think of. Nor is it irrational. It's not stupid wisdom, you know. Often people are either for mind or against mind. So they're either for rationality or they're actually for anything other than rationality. Does that make sense? You often get one of two. People in both camps, you know. Both of them have their extraordinary limitations. So it's not going from the rational mind backwards to something that's not even rational. It's actually going beyond. There's a bigger intelligence, do you know, that actually starts to, that's what you tap into when you're just, when your life is, when you are flow, in flow. You still, there's decisions to be made, there's directions to go, there's things to be done. But when you just fall into this flow, which is also a great intelligence, it's just like the right thing to do is just obvious. It's not like you figured it out. It's not like you've even convinced yourself. Because when you're in that kind of flow, you're not even asking, is this the right or wrong thing? It's just obvious. In the same way that when you walk, it's obvious you put your left foot in front of your right foot and they go and so. It's just obvious. You know, if you had to figure it out how to walk out of this room, we'd never make it out of this room. Do you know? Now, what do I put down first, the ball of my foot or the heel of my foot or the middle of my foot or the side of my, you know, we'd be sunk. There used to be, in the 18th century, a great Zen master, Bonki, quite well loved, and he was well loved by the general population, but it took him a long time to get accepted by the Zen hierarchy. They really didn't like him. Until they noticed he was attracting hordes by the thousands. Do you know? 3, 4, 5,000 people. I always thought that'd be an interesting talk to go to. 4, 5,000 people with no amplification. You're not going to have a little guy at a chair with a small voice that's being amplified. You know, you'd have to bellow it out to be heard, you know? So anyway. But he would, most of his teaching was actually just pointing out all the ways what he called the unborn Buddha mind functioned. He would point out, like, do you notice that you hear that crow in the background and you heard it without any intention? You don't know how you heard it. You don't know how you listened to it. You didn't decide to listen to it. It was just heard, right? When somebody throws a ball your way, your hands just come up to catch the ball. You don't know how they came up to catch the ball, but they do. And so he would point in all these ways that this unborn Buddha mind, this intelligence, was actually continuously at work. And his great emphasis was, you don't have to go create that intelligence. You don't have to go find it. It's operating all the time everywhere. You just have to notice it. Stop discounting it. Do you know? Because we think things are highly intelligent that are actually extraordinarily intelligent. I mean, just to open and close your hand. There are people right now in laboratories, robotics laboratories all around the world, still trying to find out how can we make something that actually duplicates this hand with its extraordinary sensitivity, its spontaneity. How does it do that? Just a hand. So there's something amazing, sort of wisdom that's happening that we're not taught to trust. In fact, we're taught the opposite, actually. We're taught, like, that kind of wisdom, that's stupid. That's like Neolithic wisdom. Why pay attention to it? But you may have noticed, I imagine most of you in this room have noticed at times when your self-concern has just took a vacation for a while, for you don't even know why, your mind is relaxed. And as I said, you just seem to somehow know what to do in given situations. You just know. And you don't even know how you know. You just know. Just like this way and that way and this way and that way. And then once you start to notice it, ooh, look at my life is going so nicely. There's this wonderful flow, and it seems so much easier than it seemed before, except the situations of life haven't changed, just my relationship. And your mind starts to go, wow, how am I doing that? And just about the time you ask that question, it's like a car that's running perfectly, and you, all of a sudden it goes clunk, clunk, clatter, clatter, you know, start. You know, as soon as you said to yourself, wow, this car operates wonderfully, all by it, you know, and it starts. Because the conceptual mind is getting in there and trying to take credit, to usurp. So it's one of the things that's often not taught, even in spirituality, where one is encouraged so often to come into a state of listening, which is what silence is, which is what to stop means. To stop means listen. If you want the quickest way just to stop, just listen. All of your senses wide open, just listen. And if you do, you can feel there is a stopping in it. You don't know how anything stopped. You're not making it stop. You're not controlling anything. You've just shifted your attention into a very open state of listening, you see. And there's a sense of stop. There's a feeling of it, right? There's the energy of it. There's the presence of it. There's the beauty of it. I heard this wonderful cellist. I forgot her name. It was a woman, wonderful, quite famous cellist, and she was teaching a master class to other quite accomplished cellists, but they were tended to be younger, her kind of up-and-coming prodigies, and she was teaching this master class, and she was, you know, teaching, she was having them play music, and of course they were all, you know, they were all quite wonderful and lovely, and yet the thing that she kept emphasizing to them is she would say, you're focused way too much on the music. You're focused too much on the notes. You're focused too much on your technique. You're fantastic at it, by the way. You're all prodigies at that. But what you're missing is you're not paying any attention to the quiet moments in between the notes. And she said, it's the space in between the notes. That's what makes music. Notes don't make music. It's the spaces between the notes. It's not the noise part that's music, it's the quiet parts that's music. You see, because just noise, it's like a big, if it's just noise with no stillness, no interlude, it just, you know, after a while, you know, that symphony gets old. And so she was trying to get them not only to understand what she was saying, but actually to sort of imbibe it, to feel what it is to pay equal attention to the space between the notes, to the music that you can't hear, as they had all been taught to listen to the notes and the music that you can hear. And it was very difficult for her, and it was very difficult for them to get it. But when she'd be working with one of them, and when they'd start to get it, you could hear the difference in the music. It was the same notes. The timing was pretty much the same. You couldn't put your finger on what's different, but you could absolutely hear the difference. It was like the difference between a fantastically gifted musician playing a piece of music and an absolute virtuoso, just a master. That was the difference. And I remember watching this and I thought, she knows how to listen. She knows how to listen. She's, of course, hearing the notes and the music and the timing and all of that. But she's also listening to the quietness, to the space between the notes. And how is the music shaping the silence, you see? Because that's music, when the music shapes the silence. And it's that quality that one so often misses, you know? I get asked by people with some regularity, you know, well, Ajay, how did you do this, or how did you figure that out, or how did you come to this, and how did you come to that? And over the years, when I started, I would get questions like this, whether it would be, you know, in gatherings like this, or it would be in mail or email or something. And I started to, it dawned on me one day, I thought, oh, like it was a surprise to me. It was really a surprise. I thought, oh, I get it. They think I figured it all out. This person actually thinks that I figured something out. And then I applied what I figured out, and that actually led to some result. And it like caught me by surprise, because I didn't even understand that that's, you know, was how people approach all this. And I thought, oh, that's what they think. They think I figured it out. And the reason it was so surprising, you wouldn't think it would be surprising, would you? I mean, I can be quite slow, obviously. But you wouldn't think it would be surprising. But the reason it was is because a long time ago, what I'd realized is my understanding of everything was my delusion. That was my delusion. What I thought I understood, I didn't actually understand at all. That's why so much of it didn't actually work. You know, because I thought many things, you know. And then I realized so much of what I imagined actually wasn't true. So much of what I was trying to apply, trying to figure out. In fact, so many of the things that I had thought I figured out, I realized I hadn't figured out anything at all. And it actually hadn't worked at all. Which is actually a hell of a thing to figure out, you know. When you figure out that figuring things out in the realms that we're talking about. Now, of course, when I'm not talking about practical things, you know, when you're at work or you're figuring out how to build a house or a better this or a better that, there's a time for that use of mind. I think that goes without saying. So we imagine someone, you know, whatever place we think they got to spiritually, that they're there because they figured something vital out. With actually just the opposite. It's because they've unfigured things out. They've unknown what they thought they knew. I know a hell of a lot less now, I can guarantee you. I mean multitudes less now than I did 25 years ago. I am way dumber than I was 25 years ago, if we measure intelligence simply by the things we think we figured out. And of course, if that was an end, then it could just lead us to like, okay, great, he's unfigured everything out, but that doesn't sound very intelligent. You know, what does he do? Sit there on the couch drooling when somebody asks him what he wants? You know, that doesn't, so if it was, that was an end point, that would be, you know, that would be also silly. That would be another sort of regression, right? But as I said, it opens us to a deeper intelligence, a deeper love as well, but a much deeper intelligence. And the deeper intelligence has nothing really so much to do about broad, overreaching ideas. The deeper intelligence is what operates now, this instant. Have you ever noticed when you've had some insight, whatever the insight may be, but a moment of aha, or I'll be darned, a moment of insight, that the insight when it comes seems perfect to that moment. It's that moment of cognito, aha, I get it, whatever it was, right? Aha. And then 2 weeks later, you try to apply your moment of cognito to another moment, and you go, it just does, why isn't it working? It was so perfect. It seemed so universal. It seemed like a truth that was meant for all of time, right? And then you go back to your journal where you wrote it down, you know, your insight, and you recorded it, and you read it again, and for the first few days after you wrote it down, when you'd read it, you'd go like, aha, yes, it's beautiful, it's lovely, yes, it's solved, it helps me to see through so much. And then 2 or 3 weeks later, or 4 weeks later, you read the same thing, it's like, well, what the hell did I ever think was amazing about that? Or, boy, it sounds amazing, but why doesn't it have any impact anymore? You see? That's what I mean by even when we see something very profound and very beautiful and that just is an aha moment, it's that wisdom and that intelligence breaking forth into that moment. And that wisdom and that intelligence is perfect for that moment, but only that moment. The next moment, you need another aha. So often, it takes a long time for, I think, many of us in spirituality to realize that collecting our ahas and thinking, if I just get enough aha moments and remember them and then figure out how to apply them, that that's somehow going to really work out for me. You know, I think we do that to some extent until we don't. And then at some point when that's broken down, you realize it doesn't actually work that way. Even any more than when a parent is teaching a child how to ride a bike and they hold on to the back seat as the child's, you know, turning the pedals, and then they let go and the child gets, you know, like 10, 15 feet before they pile it into the grass, hopefully the grass, do you know? And then, but they feel that, that's those 10 or 15 feet, I don't know if you remember, they're bliss. They're like a continuous, aha, wow, aha, until you fall, right? Or when a child first learns to start learning to walk, gets those 2 or 3 steps, and you can see it in their eyes, like, aha, ah, ah, boom, right? Now, if they could have the cognitive capacity that, say, an adult has, and they could, like, write that down. Now, I put the right foot in front of the left, and the arms kind of went like this, and I kind of wiggled the midsection, and that helped me find balance, and it was perfect. Right? And then you'd read that, and then you'd stand back up, and they let go of you, and you go, whoop, you know? Because that was sort of a bodily aha, right? Aha, not all ahas, just a bodily aha. Your system has learned something. But you can't then take that and reapply it. You have to get up again. Not that it has no impact on the next moment, it does. But the impact isn't something you can necessarily intellectually apply. So when his spiritual teachings for hundreds of years have talked about resting in the unknown, they're not talking about resting in some sort of mystical, wacky, weird state you call the unknown. I'm in the unknown. Woo. Do you know, because you can associate the unknown with something like that, right? The unknown. Okay, here I am. It's actually something much more practical. The unknown is just, it's like, it's not a state you get into. It's a current truth about your life at any instant that you recognize. Do you know what's going to happen a minute from now? Do you know how your heart beats? Do you know how to take your next breath? Do you know what you're going to think a minute before you think it? Do you know if your arm is going to go up or down before it does? And if it does, do you know why it does it? How much do we actually know, actually, in any given instant? We really don't know much, do we? I mean, you may remember how to tie your shoes, or do what you have to do when you go to work, or whatever. But all that's relatively, that's on the surface. So when it's spiritual teaching suggests the unknown, it's not like get yourself in a really weird mystical state called the unknown. It's actually saying, look, here and now, you are in it. You are it. It's happening. Have you noticed? Or do you keep continually telling yourself that you actually know what's happening? Does that make sense? And when you touch it, you immediately start to, it has a, there's a beauty to it. Because the unknown is the place that's free of suffering. There's not suffering in the unknown because there's no struggle. There's no struggle until you try to know. Imagine your mind is busy. I know you're all so advanced, your minds are never busy, but imagine it happening to somebody else. Imagine that your mind is busy. And you've spent lots of years trying to get your mind not to be busy, right? And it hasn't worked out so well. I mean, moments when it spontaneously calms down, but it always spontaneously calms down, and not necessarily when you want or plan it. So your mind, just imagine your mind is busy. Trying to calm it down, trying to calm it down, trying to do anything. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, it just comes to you. Oh, after years and years and years and years of trying to have your mind a bit calmer, all of a sudden you realize something, not the something that was hidden, you see, something that was right out in the open. What you realize is, oh, I get it. A cognito hits you. I get it. I don't know how to quiet my mind. Aha! It's nothing new, is it? It was that way before. It was that way 20 years ago when you started trying to calm your mind. You didn't know how to do it then either. 20 years of trying to calm it, and here you are. And you realize, aha, I don't know how to do it. It hits you. I don't know how to do it. In the moment that you realize, I don't know how to do it, it's calm. Everything's fine. Everything's perfectly fine. Even if it starts going again, your mind starts moving, even then, it's still fine. Because you know that you don't know how to make it other than it is. You know that, though. Not because someone told you, but imagine, you got this an insight. I don't know how to calm the darn thing. I've never known, and I don't know now, and I probably won't know in the next moment. That's what's true. And all of a sudden, the darn thing calms down. How did that happen? I didn't do anything. I didn't even know how to do anything. I wasn't applying anything. How dare it calm down without me? All I did was admit that I didn't know how to calm it down, and the thing calmed down. Where does that leave me, you see? It's like the spiritual teaching of stop, just stop. How do I stop? How do I stop? How do I stop? How do I stop? Can you tell me how to stop? Hello, can you tell me how to stop? I've read 1,000 spiritual books about stop, and I still can't figure out how to stop. In fact, I think I was more stopped before I was trying to stop than I am now. I'm sort of like constipated with stopping. And do you know how to stop? Do you see? And then all of a sudden it hits you. Oh, I get it. I don't know how to stop. I don't know how. stop. Until your mind goes, how did I do that? But of course, the same truth is there. I don't know. Now, from that place, again, this place of the unknown, it's not a place, it's not an end point in for itself. I mean, it's nice, you feel at rest, you feel not as conflicted, you feel more open, more peaceful. That's wonderful. But we all know that that kind of peace and simplicity can disappear as soon as you walk out this door. Or as soon as someone wants to talk to you. Or as soon as you get in your car. It can all just disappear, can it not? So as an end point, it just becomes another sort of state you try to hold on to. Or you start to notice from that state of openness, something can finally start to move in you. Something can start to move in you. Something of great intelligence, great love, great selflessness, great compassion. That's where it moves from. And that's the place that sometimes, if you have sort of a fierce moment of grace, that you get so challenged that you stop struggling. And all of a sudden, in that fierceness, that moment of incredible challenge that may overwhelm you, you just stop. Or it stops you. I remember being told in a gathering like this years ago about a guy who was driving down a windy road in the mountains late at night. He was very, very sleepy. Twisty mountain road. He suddenly wakes up. His car has gone off the road, gone straight in a corner. He'd gone to sleep. He wakes up just tipping the treetops of about 80-foot tall pine trees. His car is just flying, tipping the tops of the tree, 80-foot tall pine trees. He wakes up. That's where he is. Can you imagine? The middle of the night. Last thing you knew, you were on the road, kind of sleepy. Well, you know, and all of a sudden and at that moment, all of a sudden, something in him completely stopped. Completely and utterly stopped. And he said, and he survived, actually. Those trees kind of took the brunt of the car's descent enough that he survived this. And it actually opened his whole spiritual life. Because he said, at 80 feet high, cresting, just skimming those treetops of those pine trees that had gone off the road, I said, I woke up and something was just so overwhelmed that my whole system stopped. And he says, you know, that moment, that was the greatest peace I'd ever experienced in my entire life. That car cresting those treetops. And ever since that time, he had been asking, how do I get that back? Of course, right? How do I get that back? You know? So that moment was so, obviously you wake up, your senses, your mind, everything would just be so instantaneously overloaded that it just stops. It's like it goes on tilt. And when that mechanism stops, there's no problem. Even death, tree, car pummeling off the road through trees is not a problem. So in moments of great challenge, and they can be big moments of challenge when big things happen, like your car skimming the top of 80-foot tall pine trees, or they can be moments of small challenge when you're maybe sitting in a room like this and you're in a state of confusion or turmoil or something's difficult going on in your life, whatever it is, those moments of challenge, what we've been taught is in various ways to contract, try to figure it all out, come up with a solution. We haven't been taught to listen to the space between the notes. Because we haven't been taught that there's anything worthwhile in those space between those notes. We've just been taught it's just space, it's just quiet. But moments of real challenge can really open us to those moments. They might not. You might just keep contracting and keep trying to figure it out and get in more confusion and all the rest. But see, eventually, at some point, you just realize, you just stay there. You just stay in that car, 80 feet above the ground, skimming the treetops. You just stay in that place. I mean, why not? Just because you realize that is what gives you access to not only the greatest peace, but the greatest sort of intelligence of how to act and react, how to move, how to respond. It's one of the greatest things that I got from the tradition that I sort of trained in. They call it training in Zen. It gives you an idea of the approach. My mom used to call it Buddha boot camp. It is like very much like it. But in Zen, the big emphasis is not just on your realization. That's sort of groundwork. The big emphasis is, can you express it? So if you go into a Zen master in yoga, I realize that I am pure emptiness. They're probably not going to clap their hands and say, congratulations, well done, old boy. Right? They're probably going to say, like, show it to me. How old is it? When was your emptiness born? When does it die? How big is it? Can you swallow it right now? And if you're in your mind goes, because you can have it. That doesn't mean your realization isn't real, right? But it means you may not, and often haven't, discovered the function of your realization. How it functions, how it moves, how it responds. So in Zen, there's a great emphasis, not just on realization, but the activity of it, the life of it, the response of it. How does it move? Do you know? And the thing about it is you can't figure it out. You cannot figure it out. And yet we don't all need a bunch of ancient Zen koans to push us in that direction. Your life is a perfect koan. Your life is a perfect riddle that's always asking us to respond. Respond, 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 respond. You've realized something? Respond. You had your enlightenment experience on Sunday? Respond Sunday night. Monday morning going to work for sure. Life's going to be asking you, right? Can you live this? Can you respond? What is it to respond? And then, of course, we then try to figure that out. Now, how can I live from this state of spontaneity and peace and openness and infinite consciousness? And you just can't figure it out. But if you start to listen to that space between the notes, if you realize that the greatest moments of knowing come from resting in the unknown, the greatest moments of aha come from I don't know how. That's where they come from. Then you start to develop a deep, deep, intuitive sort of trust. But we have to see through the various addictions that get in the way of this way of being. Because we have great addictions to approval, to being understood, to being agreed with, to being loved, to being appreciated. All these things, we're told these are good, right? I mean, it feels good, isn't it? Doesn't it feel good when you're appreciated? When you're loved? When you're acknowledged? When someone says, I understand you. I value your opinion. I mean, these things feel good, right? And so we think, that's good. I want that. I feel happy when I get that. I feel happy when someone understands me and loves me and approves of me and holds me in high esteem. I like that. That makes me happy. That makes anybody feel good, doesn't it? It feels good, no matter who you are. But what they don't tell us is, as we're receiving that, is it's not, there's no problem with someone feeling that way or expressing it. There's no problem with even receiving it. But what they don't tell you is, my dear, you are slowly and inextricably being addicted to a very nasty drug. By God, it's going to get you probably for the rest of your life. You're going to be a junkie to approval and appreciation and acknowledgement and being loved for the rest of your life. And when you don't get your drug, you will exhibit all the symptoms of withdrawal. You'll be anxious, unhappy, afraid. Probably more than anything, you'll be upset, offended. Do you see? That's what they don't tell you. That's what nobody tells us, right? So we get addicted to these various responses from people around us. We find our sense of well-being in all of that. Not that there's anything wrong with it. There's nothing wrong with telling someone you love them or appreciate them or give them acknowledgement or love them. That's not the problem. The problem is when any of us become addicted to any of that. And the strange thing is, the less of it we've had in our life, the more addicted we are to it. Because we think, I didn't get enough of my drug of choice. If I get enough of my drug of choice, I'll be happy. Now, I say this because only when you start to see it, and you see it, I can't even tell. People have asked me, like, how do you see this in such a way that the addiction goes away? And I can't tell you because I don't know how it happened for me. What happened for me? Nobody told me this. I just started to look at it one day, and I started to notice, this is drug stuff. This is addiction. This is like my happiness is in your hands stuff. This is terrible. Do you know? I mean, in one sense, it's all nice to be loved and appreciated and all that. And there's a time when to give people that is nice. It's still fine to give it. You know, I try to give it to people when it seems obvious to do so. But when we become addicted to it, God damn, it's nasty, isn't it? Have you noticed? It is terrible. It's a terrible drug. And most human beings, 99.9% of human beings, you know, these things that I just mentioned, they're addicted to this to the hilt. I mean, just like a heroin junkie. And if they don't get their hit often enough, they get very uneasy. But when we can see it, it's like asking a drug addict, like, well, how did you stop being a drug addict? What are they going to tell you? Like it was a technique? like I sat down and meditated and figured it out and then applied the 3-point program that came to me in my meditation, and I stopped my addiction. It doesn't happen that way, does it? Usually addiction in some way happens when this addictive quality is just so much in your face that nothing in you can believe that there's anything good in it anymore. You see, nothing in you can believe it. I've had a number of friends that were alcoholics for a certain period of time. One of my really good friends, when he was an alcoholic, he was very intelligent and open. We'd sit down, we'd talk about his alcoholism. Oh yeah, I know I'm an alcoholic, but it was very much out here. He hadn't paid a huge price for it. At least he didn't think he had, functional, smart, and all that. Then we'd talk about it. I'll never forget when he came into work, because we worked together at the time. He came into work and he looked at me and he just said, "I'm an alcoholic." And I said, "I know." I mean, he admitted that before. He wasn't even defensive about it, but there's something different. And so I said, "What happened?" And he said, "I caught drunk driving on 280, the freeway, going 110 miles an hour last night at 2:00 in the morning." And of course, even if you're not drunk and they catch you doing 210, you're going to jail for the night at least. And being drunk, you're definitely going to jail. And he said, all of a sudden I was found myself inside, those sort of jail cells where there's more than one person in them, the kind of holding cells, I don't know what they call them. So there's a number of people, most of them were drunk. And he says, I was in that cell and I heard the door shut. And just like in a movie scene, his hands were clutching the bars and he was looking out of the bars. And the thought he had was, "I'm an alcoholic." That was it. Before, he knew, you know what I mean? He knew, like as a thought, as an idea. At that moment, all of him knew. And that was the beginning of the end. That was the end. Because there was nothing, all the denial broke down, right? Complete breakdown. So when we can see that a lot of these states that we get deeply addicted to, and when we're addicted to them, then we become demand machines without saying it. "I demand that you love me. I demand it. I'm not going to ever tell you that, because that's too revealing, but I'll demand it anyway. I demand that you understand me. I'll probably never understand you, but I demand that you understand me. I demand that you approve of me, you see. I'm in your family, I'm your friend, I'm whatever. I demand that you approve, and I demand that you show me that you approved of me. I demand," you see what I mean? Nobody will come out and say that. Because nobody wants to reveal their addiction. But when you start to see it, you go, "My God, I was hooked." Almost everybody is. But nobody, I never knew that happiness was never going to come by even satisfying any of these demands, these wants. There's no such thing as enough. Is there any such thing as enough alcohol to an alcoholic? Maybe on a particular night, loaded enough, got the buzz enough, but not enough like forever. There's just no such thing. There's no such thing as enough to where I will have drunk so much that I'll never want to drink again. It's a lie, isn't it? I will never drink enough to where I don't want to drink again, unless you find yourself behind bars or an aha moment, however it comes, or just grace. I've talked to people that they just woke up in the morning, nothing happened, and they just thought, "That's it, I'm done." Sometimes it's just grace like that. You don't even know what happened. But when you can see this, and the reason I'm going on about this is because what I've seen, people can have very, very real glimpses of their true nature, and there can still be this very sticky, gooey tar inside of their makeup, and they don't even know it's there. It's just pulling on them always. It's not that anybody should feel bad about being addicted to any of these emotional states when It's just that when you recognize it, you can start to recognize that a lot of the avenues through which you seek your happiness are, they're impossible to pay off. They can't pay off. Because they're each, in Buddhism, they would sort of, they have this image of called a hungry ghost. And a hungry ghost is sort of a ghost-like figure with their head cocked back, their mouth wide open like this, and all this stuff's being poured into the ghost's mouth, and the, but the stomach is bottomless. So you can't give a hungry ghost enough. There's no end. It's endless. Endless samsara. Until you see it. That doesn't mean I don't like it when somebody says, hey, I like what you do, or thanks, or I love you, or, you know, I like it like the next person does. But the nice thing is when nobody has to say it. Then you're free. And the nice thing is, not only are you free, but you've freed up everybody around you. You don't, the people around you, they don't have to do that for you. They still may, you know, that's nice. We do that with each other. We share how we feel and all that kind of stuff. That's great. But we've freed the people around us from our own demand, do you know, to meet a need that they can't meet. So this may seem psychological to some people, but this is the hidden stuff that keeps people, even that have had really beautiful realizations, that often keeps them from really being able to live there. And they don't know why they keep kind of contracting back, you know? They don't know why. And, you know, there's always certain reasons why. We may not know the reasons, but there's always is reasons why we contract back. And usually it's some form of this sort of addictive kind of wanting. What can you do? You just see it. And don't take it personally, because it's not personal. It's universal. Human beings all around you, everybody you know almost, is addicted. So don't feel bad about it if you see it. It's just part of the human community, you know, it's a human thing. Because, of course, nobody gives up an addiction because they feel bad about it. You know, it doesn't work that way. In fact, the worse you feel about it, the more addicted you are. You know? You just see it. You see, because it's one thing to wake up, for consciousness to come out of that contraction, to wake up from that identification. That's beautiful, very profound. It can shift a lot of this stuff that I'm talking about. Very significant. But simultaneously, even if you do have consciousness wakes up from that identification, if there's still any of that addictive quality, it's going to pull it back, right? Because it wants something. What's in this for me? So it's not really, like I said, this may sound more psychological, but most people, when they have this sort of, I had a great realization, then I lost it, it's always because of some psychological reason. It's not because of usually some great big spiritual thing. It's just because there's something that hasn't been seen through yet. Something there. There is what I call the promise that's never kept, which is, I'll be happy when I get enough of fill in the blank. It's never kept, that promise, is it? Never, 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 never. Okay. Let's see what's on your mind, shall we?